This is a recording of Parallels Between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon, Part 1, Details of Their Distribution and Relationships to the JST, by Jeffrey D. Lindsay, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, read by Jeff Lindsay. Abstract. In previous work, unexpected textual relationships between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses that seemed consistent with the brass plates version of Genesis with similarities to the modern Book of Moses were explored. However, there is a need for further research to examine the nature of the distribution of the parallels in the Book of Mormon to the Book of Moses, to assess, for example, whether the connections are scattered randomly across the text or show any meaningful patterns. There is also a need to consider the relationship of the Book of Mormon to the rest of the Joseph Smith translation, to determine if the Book of Mormon's relationship with the Book of Moses, the first portion of the JST, is somehow unique or is consistent with the rest of Joseph's work with the translation of the Bible. Data related to both topics are treated here, showing that the Book of Mormon's relationship with the Book of Moses appears to be unique and consistent with an ancient brass plates version of Genesis that influenced Book of Mormon personalities such as Lehi, Nephi, Jacob, and Alma. Later portions of the JST lack numerous parallels with the Book of Mormon, except for a few sections that appear to have been imported from the Book of Mormon into the JST. Further, the distribution of parallels at the book level and the chapter level is consistent with a meaningful application of material from a brass plates version of Genesis by authors or speakers familiar with the brass plates. One of the most puzzling aspects of the Book of Mormon is the way it seems to draw upon specific language in the Book of Moses. A total of 146 such parallels have been found and are listed in a companion paper, Part 2, in this two-part series. The parallels often involve specific common language that cannot be readily explained by the language of the King James Bible. Noel Reynolds opened this field of investigation with a 1990 paper in which computer-aided searching found 33 parallels. Some reflected a one-way direction of influence, as if Book of Mormon writers were alluding to, quoting from, or building upon concepts and stories in the Book of Moses, or rather, a hypothetical version of Genesis on the brass plates that is similar to the Book of Moses, as Noel Reynolds has proposed. Moreover, the translation of the Book of Abraham has a different character, largely free of such connections. This suggests that the deep intertextuality between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon is not simply a natural result of Joseph's vocabulary and his familiarity with the Book of Mormon. Something unexpected is going on. Reynolds and I further explored these unexpected connections in a 2021 joint paper. There we identified a total of 97 proposed parallels between the two texts that cannot be easily explained by drawing upon the KJV Bible. At that time, we thought we had exhausted all possible parallels. In a process marked by many surprises, several more parallels seemed to present themselves without being sought, stirring a need to publish further finds in a 2024 update that brought the number of parallels to 133, far higher than we ever expected. Such a density of parallels between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon is remarkable, especially given that roughly half of the Book of Moses is simply quoting the King James Bible. This makes only a fraction eligible for consideration as non-KJV Bible parallels with the Book of Mormon. During peer review of the 2021 and 2024 papers, and in responses from readers, several excellent questions pointed to a need for further work in several areas that are addressed in this paper. These include, what can we learn from the distribution of the parallels to the Book of Moses found in the Book of Mormon? Is it largely random? Is it uniform? Does it suggest some authors are more likely to allude to Book of Moses material than others? Or does it show a steady increase over time during the translation of the Book of Mormon, as if Joseph were mentally preparing the language and themes of the future Book of Moses project? That was the first bullet point. The next one is, given that the Book of Moses is simply the first part of Joseph Smith's new translation of the Bible, the Joseph Smith translation, or JST, that ends at Genesis 6:13, are there similar connections with the rest of the JST? For example, Did Joseph gradually increase the presence of Book of Mormon language in the JST over time? And if he were increasingly drawing upon the Book of Mormon, or was as if he were increasingly drawing upon the Book of Mormon, or was the incorporation of Book of Mormon language a relatively steady phenomenon? Is there something unique about the relationship between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses versus the rest of the JST? A third bullet point. Since the recognition of parallels has been largely based on precise common language in two translated texts, when there seems to be no a priori expectation that the translation process should yield the same language, what does this tell us about the translation process? Could some of the apparent parallels be artifacts of the translation process rather than remnants of ancient connections to the Book of Moses? And the final bullet point, number four, isn't it risky to focus on parallels to another text? Aren't such parallels also used to attack the Book of Mormon? The answer to such questions may be valuable in considering the significance and meaning, if any, of the proposed parallels. In the following sections, we address the above questions, first considering data on the distribution of the parallels in the Book of Mormon. Then we consider the question of other parallels in the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible after the Book of Moses translation. Further, we discuss the relationship between the wording choices made in the translation to English for the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon, and the significance of translator intent in making many of these parallels readily identifiable. Finally, we examine why the treatment of parallels in this study is quite different than the common use of parallels by Book of Mormon critics. In this analysis, we rely on the current set of 146 proposed parallels, which are listed and supplemented with discussion related to recent new finds and updates in Part 2 of this series. What do we gain by considering the findings of this project? The following findings presented in prior publications are important for several reasons, which are reinforced by the present paper. And then several bullet points follow. First, an apparent awareness that Book of Mormon writers seem to have had a text related to our Book of Moses implies that they may have made deliberate allusions to Book of Moses stories, concepts, and specific phrases. Bullet point two, intertextuality with the Book of Moses may be a useful tool for better understanding once-overlooked allusions in the Book of Mormon or backstories that enhance the text. And three, numerous allusions or echoes in the dictated 1829 Book of Mormon text pointing to material in the later produced Book of Moses may be meaningful evidence for the antiquity and authenticity of both sacred texts. The present paper adds further reasons to consider the hypothesis of a brass plates version of Genesis related to the Book of Moses, including the distribution of parallels with the Book of Moses in the Book of Mormon suggests that Book of Mormon writers most familiar with the brass plates provided the most parallels to the Book of Moses, yielding further insights into the work of Book of Mormon authors. And a second bullet point, consideration of the rest of the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible after the Book of Moses material shows unique features of the Book of Moses that are not typical of the later material in the JST, but which may be consistent with the existence of a text provided through a unique revelatory process on the brass plates and closely related to the Book of Moses. And the final bullet point, useful information that the data may provide on the translation process related to both texts. The many common phrases and words shared by the two translated texts, but typically not with the KJV Bible, suggest a consistency in the translation of the two texts that may point to an agenda of whoever provided the English translations for the Book of Mormon and for the Book of Moses, as discussed later. In sum, these factors can enhance our understanding of the Book of Mormon, of Joseph's translation process, of the significance of intertextuality in Latter-day Saint scriptures, and of the translation methods involved. They also can provide standalone evidence for the ancient origins and authenticity of both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses. The distribution of parallels in the Book of Mormon. For the first 33 parallels that Reynolds uncovered, he observed that the writers of the small plates, whom we might expect would be particularly well-schooled in the brass plates, are responsible for most of the Book of Moses' influence that he had identified. Quote, It is also impressive that most of the influence from the Book of Moses in the Book of Mormon shows up early in the small plates and the writings of the first generation of Book of Mormon prophets. Significantly, those who had custody and long-term, first-hand access to the brass plates. Many of the later passages that use Book of Moses terminology and concepts tend to repeat earlier Nephite adaptations of the original materials. And that's from Noel Reynolds. In our subsequent, end quote, in our subsequent works, similar observations were made. The small plate authors and Alma, too, also expressly a student of the brass plates, seem to be the sources for a disproportionate number of parallels. But details of the distribution were not examined. It's time we examine the distribution in more detail. Is the distribution among the chapters of the Book of Mormon roughly uniform, independent of authors or topics, as though the parallels might best be explained as coincidence arising from Joseph's language, or does it show other characteristics? Let's look at the data. Determining the distribution of parallels. A spreadsheet was prepared that considered the number of distinct parallels in each chapter and the number of distinct verses in each chapter of the Book of Mormon that were involved in parallels. Ratios could then be computed, such as the number of parallels or distinct verses involved in parallels per chapter, per book, per 1,000 words in each book, etc. For such ratios, chapters that were essentially a direct quotation from the KJV were excluded, though in two cases, one or two introductory verses before the direct quotation were not excluded. Thus, 3 Nephi 12 was listed as having two verses, and 3 Nephi 24 was listed as having one verse. In 2 Nephi 27, where Nephi 1 is working with Isaiah 29, but with extensive changes, no verses were excluded. Short quotations throughout the Book of Mormon were not excluded. The effect on overall statistics would have been minor had that been done, but would have slightly increased the calculated density of parallels. Some parallels relate to passages in the Book of Mormon with multiple verses. In those cases, the overall passage might be listed, followed by a note on the specific verses that have language directly linking them to a Book of Moses passage, such as, quote, Helaman 10, 4-10, specifically verses 5 and 9. End quote, for parallel number 139. In such cases, only the more specific verses were used in the analysis. The distinct number of parallels present in each chapter was calculated. Those parallels per chapter can then be summed up to give a total number per book. That sum will frequently include duplicate parallels that were used in different chapters. The repeated use of parallels in different sections of a book may be meaningful, but the total number of distinct parallels per book may be more desirable for some comparisons, i.e., not counting duplicate occurrences of a parallel, and thus was also calculated. Table 1 lists the books, the number of qualified chapters per book, excluding chapters that are entirely a quotation from the KJV, the total parallels per book, and the distinct parallels per book, free of duplicate instances. So, Table 1, I'll take a look at that, but I'll give you a few highlights. It's labeled, Table 1 is Basic Results for Parallels in Each Book of the Book of Mormon. There are five columns. There's the name of the book. There are qualified chapters, the number of qualified chapters, which can be called Q. There's the total parallels per book, or S. There's the average parallels per qualified chapter, which is Q divided by S, and the distinct parallels per book. So 1 Nephi, for example, has 20 qualified chapters, a total of 58 parallels. Average parallels per qualified chapter would then be 2.90, and the distinct parallels per book are 33. 2 Nephi has 18 qualified chapters, total parallels per book, 63. The average parallels per qualified chapter would be 3.5, and the distinct parallels per book, 45. Jacob also has relatively high numbers with 7 qualified chapters, 18 parallels per book, 2.57 average parallels per qualified chapter, and the distinct parallels per book are 16. And a lot of other numbers. Please take a look at Table 1. I'll mention also Alma, for example, has 63 qualified chapters, 118 total parallels in that book, 1.87 average parallels per qualified chapter. So that's lower than 1 Nephi, 2 Nephi, or Jacob. They were in the twos or threes. And then the distinct parallels per book in Alma is 55. So 1.87 average parallels per qualified chapter, 55 total distinct parallels per book when there were a total of 118. So definitely some duplicates. And there's just a general pattern here that 1 Nephi, 2 Nephi, Jacob have a pretty high number of average parallels per qualified chapter. Drops down for the other small plates writers, one or two, one for Enos, two for Jerem, one for Omni, one for Words of Mormon is the average. This is only one chapter. Mosiah has an average of 1.36 parallels per qualified chapter, much lower than Nephi and Jacob. Alma, 1.87 coming up. Helaman has 2.81 with 29 distinct parallels in that book. And 3rd Nephi drops down to 1.35. 4th Nephi, just one book, has a high number, 3.0. Mormon, low number, 0.89. Ether, 2.53. I'll explain later, that's largely because of high discussions of secret combinations, which are one of the areas with many parallels. And then Moroni, ending out the list, has 1.2 average parallels in its 10 qualified chapters, with total parallels per book of 12, and they're distinct. There's 12 distinct parallels in that book. Continuing with the text, the density of parallels across the books of the Book of Mormon can also be considered in terms of the number of verses involved in the parallels. Table 2 shows the number of qualified verses for each book after excluding chapters from the KJV. After the excluded chapters from the KJV have been removed. The cumulative verses involved is the sum across all parallels of relevant verses in each book. Here, a single verse might be involved in more than one parallel. The next column removes such duplicates and only lists the number of unique verses from each book that are involved in at least one parallel. The final column is the ratio R1, the unique number of verses involved in parallels, divided by the number of qualified verses. So, let's look at Table 2. It's labeled the verse level density of the parallels. So we have five columns. Book is the first column, qualified verses. So similar to qualified chapters in Table 1, but now we've got these total number of verses that aren't clearly just lifted from Isaiah, and then cumulative verses involved, 93, then unique verses involved, and R1, that's unique verses divided by total verses. So 1 Nephi, we'd list 570 qualified verses, and again, to be excluded, it's like the whole chapter is going to be dominated by Isaiah or something, but qualified verses that don't have that, 570. Some of those could still be Isaiah quotes scattered around. Cumulative verses involved are 93, and that means 93 verses have parallels, are part of the parallels of 1 Nephi. The unique number of verses involved is 84 in 1 Nephi. And the ratio of unique verses to total verses is 0.147, which is almost 15%. That is actually surprisingly high. 2 Nephi has similar numbers. It has 468 qualified verses, 110 verses involved with parallels, having at least one parallel. The unique number of verses is 76. So, that difference would be 34. That means 34 of those 110 verses that are involved have more than one parallel in those verses. So there's 76 unique verses without those 34 where there's some duplicate verses involved. R1, the unique verses divided by total verses, is 0.162, or a little over 16%. Again, that's very high. Jacob has 203 qualified verses, 31 cumulative verses involved, or 31 verses involved in parallels, 27 unique verses, and the R1 ratio, unique verses by total verses, is 0.133, or 13.3%. Just giving you some other numbers, I guess I'll give most of them to you. Enos has 27 qualified verses, one verse is involved in parallels, one unique verse, the ratio R1 is 0.037 or 3.7%. Jerem has 15 qualified verses, two cumulative verses involved in parallels, two unique verses, ratio is 0.133, back to 13%, similar to Jerem. Omni with 30 qualified verses, two verses are involved, two unique verses, 0.067. Words of Mormon, 18, 1, 1, 0.056, so 5.6%. Messiah, 773 verses, 58 involved with parallels, 54 unique verses, that ratio R1 is 0.07 or 7.0% really. Alma, 1975 verses, nearly 2,000, 183 involved with parallels, 143 unique verses, and that works out to be 0.072 or 7.2%. Helaman, 497 for verses, 69 involved, 58 unique verses, 0.117 or 11.7% with the ratio for unique verses the total. Third Nephi, 638 verses, 56 involved, 47 unique, 7.4% is R1. Fourth Nephi, 49 verses in that chapter, four involved in parallels, three unique verses, 0.061 or 6%, 6.1%. Mormon, 227, 9, 7, and 3.1%. Ether, 433, 69 involved, 41 unique, 0.095 or 9.5%. And Moroni, 163 verses, 15 involved, 9 unique, 0.055 unique verses per total verses. So that's like less than a third of what Nephi is doing in 2 Nephi with his 16% down to just 5.5% in Moroni. Interesting patterns. On to the text. In 1 Nephi, for example, out of 570 verses after excluding Isaiah chapters, 84 verses are part of at least one parallel, as seen in Table 1. There are 33 distinct parallels. As seen in Table 1, there are 33 distinct parallels involved with 1 Nephi. The R1 value of 0.147 indicates that nearly 15% of the qualified verses in 1 Nephi have allusions to Book of Moses material beyond what can be readily explained by an appeal to the KJV. That's a surprisingly high level. 2 Nephi's R1 value is even higher, 0.162 or over 16%, over twice the level seen in Mosiah, Alma, 3 Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni. As this study began, I never would have guessed that such a high proportion of the verses Nephi 1 penned would include links to the Book of Moses. The column chart of Figure 1 compares R1 between the books of the Book of Mormon to make it easier to visualize that parameter. So Figure 1 just has a bar chart. It has each bar is labeled with the books of the Mormon in order, first Nephi all the way up to Moroni, and it has a bar giving those numbers, so it shows high bars on the left with first and second Nephi and Jacob, also high for Jerem, but of course it's a small book, and then lower for other books with Mormon and Ether, Mormon being quite low, 3.5 as I recall, and then Ether somewhat higher, Moroni also being low. Figure 1 is labeled R1 values, or the fraction of unique verses in each book that are involved in the 146 parallels with the Book of Moses. Okay, going on with the text, figure 2 compares two averaging approaches for the parallels per chapter. The first series shown is the average of the parallels per chapter, or the sum divided by the number of qualified chapters, while the second series is the parallels per chapter per 1,000 words, or the sum of the parallels per chapter in each book divided by the number of words in the qualified chapters, and expressed as per 1,000. The error bars with 95% confidence intervals shown for the two series are based on the variance for each book, including excluding single chapter books. You can't get a variance for a single chapter. When duplicate parallels are eliminated by only counting distinct parallels for each book, the results are lower but still follow similar trends as shown in Figure 3. Okay, so we've got Figure 2 and Figure 3. Let me describe those. Figure 2 is labeled, there's a label at the top that says distinct parallels per chapter, average per chapter, and per 1,000 words. And for each book, 1st Nephi, 2nd Nephi, etc., there's two bars. One is labeled with cross-hatching, and one is a solid bar. The cross-hatched one is average per chapter. The solid bar is average per 1,000 words. And there's some error bars. So the error bars are somewhat high in 2nd Nephi and 1st Nephi, but they still are distinct from the ones that are low. We show high numbers, averages, between like 2.5 and close to 3 for 1st Nephi, a little higher for 2nd Nephi, getting up to 3.5 as the average per chapter, and then drops down for other books. Figure 3 shows distinct parallels. The caption for Figure 2 says average distinct parallels per chapter, average per qualified chapter, and per 1,000 words. Error bars, 95% confidence intervals, are shown using variance for each book with more than one chapter. Then Figure 3 is distinct parallels per book, averages per chapter, and 1,000 words. So Figure 2 was distinct parallels per chapter. Now we're looking at distinct parallels per book. So we're averaging per chapter and also per 1,000 words. And that's per 1,000 words of the book, not per 1,000 words of that individual chapter. Okay, but the results are still quite similar, but lower. So now that we're averaging per book as opposed per chapter, we have, for example, 1st Nephi being a little higher than 1.5 for the per book, whereas the average per 1,000 words is more like 1.5. Jumps up for Nephi, where the two bars are about 2.4 and about 2.2. So it's a somewhat different flavor. 4th Nephi stands out, but of course it's only a very short one chapter book, which has a high number per book. But for books that have significant number of chapters, as we see 1st Nephi, 2nd Nephi, Jacob, and Jerem, small, maybe it could be neglected, but those are high. Mosiah, Alma are low. Helaman goes up somewhat. 3rd Nephi is low. Mormon's low. Similar patterns. Continuing. Again, single chapter books are expected to have high variability because of the small sample size of the text being considered, so conclusions based on them must be made cautiously. Overlooking the high average in the single chapter book of Jerem, both averages of both charts show 2nd Nephi as the highest source of parallels to the book of Moses, with Jacob and 1st Nephi also having high levels of parallels. Other lengthy books, such as Mosiah, Alma, and 3rd Nephi, have significantly lower averages. Helaman has a higher average in part because of the extensive content on secret combinations, which is a very significant source of parallels. However, it has a wide range of topics having parallels to the book of Moses. The distribution may be judged. Considering what we can infer about Book of Mormon authors and their apparent familiarity with the brass plates. Nephi 1 and Jacob, like their father Lehi 1, who was quoted several times by Nephi 1, had obviously become familiar with the brass plates after Nephi 1 retrieved them from Jerusalem. This commenced a period of intense study by Lehi, who then taught his family the brass plates. How well that instruction permeated the lives of his descendants may vary. Enos, for example, does not come across as a lifelong student of the scriptures as he begins his hunt. Most of the various authors in Omni also seem to have lapsed in their devotion to the word. While it is risky to rely on conclusions drawn from single chapter books given the small sample size, Jerem's relatively high use of parallels may deserve to be taken seriously, in light of Jerem also being one of the richest examples of extensive chiasmus, indicating that he took the Hebrew scriptures seriously and had studied them carefully. Enos, though, also has evidence of possible chiasmus. It is interesting that the books of Mormon, Mosiah, and 3 Nephi have such low numbers of parallels. When we look at the distribution of parallels per chapter, the low average for Mosiah will make sense. In 3 Nephi, it may be that the Messiah, given the giver of the law, was more focused on introducing a new dispensation and the themes of the New Testament to the Nephites than in alluding to scripture that the Nephites already possessed. As for Mormon, he may have been familiar with the brass plates version of Genesis, though possibly a reformed Egyptian version from his day. However, the focus of his personal writings as military leader of a doomed nation might not have moved him to allude frequently to that text the way earlier scribes and prophets did. In any case, there appear to be notable differences in the levels of parallels across the books, without evidence of merely random distribution or no clear temporal trend with respect to the transition of the Book of Mormon that would, for example, show a steady increase from Mosiah until the final pages of the small plates of Nephi. Familiarity with the brass plates by individual authors or speakers may be an important factor. To somewhat reduce the influence of multiple parallels involving secret combinations, figures 4 and 5 are versions of figures 2 and 3, respectively, but with parallels number 38 to 42 and number 133 removed. These are all parallels that involve secret combinations that go beyond the basic ones Noel Reynolds found. Overall, the effort to slightly downplay secret combinations does not significantly change the basic features of the distribution of parallels per chapter per book. So we've got these two figures 4 and 5. 4 is distinct parallels per chapter, average per chapter and 1,000 words, but with reduced secret combination influence by excluding a handful of secret combination parallels. And it looks very similar to the other bar charts. And likewise, figure 5, which looks at distinct parallels per book as opposed to per chapter, again with reduced secret combination influence. Okay, now back to the text. The distribution at the chapter level may be even more valuable to consider. Figure 6 shows the chapter level distribution of parallels in 1st and 2nd Nephi. Note that the peak of 13 parallels occurs in 2nd Nephi chapter 2. Part of the farewell sermon of that great student and expositor of the brass plates, the prophet Lehi, or Lehi 1. The beginning of this sermon in 2 Nephi 1 also has a high score. 2 Nephi 9, with 11 parallels, also stands out. This is a sermon rich in temple themes from Jacob, with many opportunities for allusions to the brass plates version of Genesis, also rich in temple themes, treating it as related to the Book of Moses, of course. Also, relatively high rates persist during Nephi 1's apocalyptic vision of the Gentiles and the last days in 1 Nephi 13 to 15. The local distribution within 1 and 2 Nephi tends to make sense considering the context of specific chapters, and it also does not appear to be consistent with a relatively uniform distribution based upon Joseph's word choices in dictation. Chapter 6, by the way, is subtitled, has a caption, Chapter Level Distribution of Parallels in 1 Nephi to 2 Nephi. And it shows relatively low numbers, 2, 2, 1, and 3 for the first four chapters of Nephi. And then nothing in 5 and 6. Then it kind of rises gradually, reaches a peak in 2 Nephi 2, and 2 Nephi 1 is also high. And then it sort of decays down with a big peak in 2 Nephi 9. Overall, though, high numbers. The peak in 2 Nephi and 1 Nephi 2 is 13 parallels in that chapter. 2 Nephi 9 has 11 chapters. And overall, 1 Nephi, 2 Nephi are pretty high, relatively speaking, in parallels. Figure 7 is like figure 6, but reports parallels per 1,000 words per chapter. Considering parallels per 1,000 words is a useful measure, but generally offers few surprises compared to simply looking at the raw number of parallels per chapter. Therefore, the following distribution plots for other sections of the Book of Mormon will be based simply on parallels per chapter. Figure 8 examines chapter-level parallels in Jacob through Mosiah. The distribution of Mosiah, a book produced following the loss of the 116 pages of the early Book of Mormon manuscript, is much different than seen in Jacob or 1st or 2nd Nephi, due to Messiah's large gaps free of parallels to the book of Moses. These gaps may be meaningful. The first gap or chapter free of parallels is Messiah 7, a historical chapter describing the mission of Ammon, a descendant of Zarahemla, Messiah 7:3, with his brothers, back to the land of Lehi-Nephi, where they meet King Limhi, the son of the wicked King Noah. Neither Ammon nor King Limhi are likely to have serious students of the brass, are likely to have been serious students of the brass plates. And despite some strongly religious passages, it's reasonable that no connections to the book of Moses are apparent in Messiah 7. The gap in Messiah 7 follows King Benjamin's speech and covenant-making ceremony in Messiah 1-6 that abounds in revelation and in preaching of the doctrine of Christ, issues that naturally fit with the book of Moses. The peak in figure 8 occurs with the seven parallels of Messiah 3, which covers topics such as the salvation of children, eternal life, the ministry of Christ, and other topics linked to the book of Moses. The next gap begins with the record of Zenith in Mosiah 9 and 10. Zenith describes the history of his people's arrival in the land of Lehi-Nephi, battles with the Lamanites, and naming one of his sons, wicked King Noah, to be the next king. Zenith does not appear to be a student of the scriptures, though he slightly imitates 1 Nephi 1:1 in his opening words. Chapter 11 introduces King Noah and then Abinadi. The gap continues in Messiah 12, as Abinadi condemns Noah for his wickedness and is questioned by the wicked priest of Noah. Parallels begin in Messiah 13, as Abinadi is preserved from being attacked as his face, quote, shone with exceeding luster, unquote, like Moses on Mount Sinai, verse 5, and can begin his message on salvation through Christ. The parallels from Abinadi peak in Messiah 15 as he preaches the plan of salvation, including the salvation of little children, verse 25, and other themes related to the book of Moses. Further parallels follow in Abinadi's impassioned words on salvation through Christ in Messiah 16. After the prophet Alma gives a couple more parallels in his preaching in Messiah 18 and flees from the community of King Noah, we encounter the longest gap in the Book of Mormon as we return to the prophet-less captive people of King Noah in Messiah 19. There, and in subsequent chapters, we learn more of their wickedness and cowardice. We return full circle to the arrival of Ammon and his brethren in Messiah 20 and learn the history of the discovery of the plates of ether. In chapter 22, there are successful plans made to escape from the Lamanites. The gap continues in Messiah 23 and 24 as we read the history of Alma and his peoples settling the land of Helam, going into captivity and being delivered and returning to Zarahemla. The gap continues with Messiah 25 as it shares the history of King Messiah's pronouncement to his people about the convergence of great events, including the arrival of Alma and his people, the arrival of Limhi and his people, and the discovery of ancient Jaredite records. Throughout the historical material of Messiah 19 through 25, there is not a single identified parallel to the book of Moses. This changes in Messiah 26 as a prophet of God seeks and receives revelation. We then gain more revelatory insights from the angelic visit to Alma 2 and the sons of Messiah 2. Revelation and preaching on the plan of salvation in the last four chapters of Messiah bring more parallels. Gaps and parallels thus seem to fall where they should. Figure 9 shows the distribution of parallels in the book of Alma. Here there is high variability, and some sections rich in parallels, such as the preaching of Alma and Amulek in Alma 12 and 13, with a total of 22 parallels between the two chapters. This is one of the richest concentrations of parallels in the entire Book of Mormon, and yet there are many multi-chapter gaps having no parallels. The war chapters at the end of the book show significant gaps. Historical material, unlike revelation or spiritual discourse, often has little connection to the language of the Book of Moses, even though it also describes wars and historical events. Figure 10 shows the distribution of parallels among the chapters of Helaman through 4th Nephi. 3rd Nephi has a generally low level of parallels, despite a concentration on the Son of God, which is given so much attention in the Book of Moses. Levels are higher in Helaman, with a peak in Helaman 6 that gives many details on the operations of secret combinations. Figure 11 shows the distribution for Mormon through Moroni. Interestingly, the values for Mormon's chapters are quite low, with over half of the parallels for his book being found in one chapter, Mormon 8, where he discusses several aspects of secret combinations and some other Book of Moses themes. Moroni also has a relatively low level of parallels, though he seems to have made many allusions to the brass plates version of Genesis in his work in the Book of Ether. Here he was particularly concerned about the theme of secret combinations, especially in Ether 8, with a peak of 11 parallels. In general, the parallels in the Book of Ether may largely reflect Moroni's paraphrasing of the Jaredite record and his added commentary, though the Jaredites had their own ancient records that described the rise of what Moroni and Moses called a secret combination, as the daughter of Jared noted, quote, "Whereby hath my father so much sorrow? Hath he not read the record which our fathers brought across the great deep? Behold, is there not an account concerning them of old, that they, by their secret plans, did obtain kingdoms and great glory?" Ether 8:9. That Jaredite record, though, would have predated the era of Moses and may have used different terminology, such as secret plans, instead of secret combination. The term secret plans, used in the quotation from the daughter of Jared, is also used several times in the Book of Mormon after being introduced by Alma too in Alma 37, verses 29 and 32. Here, in his counsel to Helaman, he refers to the already translated Book of Ether. We may infer that the term secret plans is based on a concept taken from the Jaredite record, while Moroni preferred to speak of secret combinations, a term also used by Nephi 1 and the Book of Moses. Not all the parallels in the Book of Ether necessarily date to Moroni's work. For example, allusions related to the flood in the Book of Ether, used in some plates, could have been original to the Jaredite record, but could later have been crafted by Moroni or a translator to make an allusion to the Book of Moses. In general, the distribution of parallels in the Book of Mormon neither reflect a random distribution nor a uniform distribution, but it is consistent with the nature of the content, e.g., historical information versus sermons or revelation, and some specific topics. There are also apparent individual differences with speakers or authors like Lehi 1, Nephi 1, Jacob, and Alma 2. These show elevated tendencies to apply brass plates material when appropriate, as in the preaching of Alma 2 and Amulek in Alma 12 and 13, or Alma 2's discourse in Alma 37 on the brass plates. The details of the distribution of parallels at various levels among verses, chapters, and books point to reasonable, logical distribution consistent with unique authors drawing upon ancient material on the brass plates in plausible ways, with the Book of Moses having a strong textual connection to the proposed brass plates material. In other words, the distribution data enhance the case for the basic proposals in the studies reported so far regarding the intertextuality of the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon, adding to the evidence that the data is not merely the result of coincidence, nor of Joseph's using common language in random ways when creating both texts. The relationships are too sophisticated and nuanced for one modern translator or author to have crafted them while dictating text to his scribes. Finally, Table 3 shows the top 40 chapters with highest numbers of parallels per 1,000 words. For chapters having at least 500 words. This excludes passages such as 3 Nephi 24, where one qualified verse with 59 words remained after removing the quotation of Micah 3, for which one parallel resulted in nearly 17 parallels per 1,000 words. Lehi's familiarity with the brass plates is reflected in the inclusion of his farewell discourse in 2 Nephi 1, ranked number 11, and 2 Nephi 2, ranked number 2. Five chapters written or spoken by Jacob appear in the top 40, Jacob 4 as number 6, 2 Nephi as number 12, 2 Nephi 9 as number 16, Jacob 6 as number 26, and Jacob 3 as number 36. Given the small number of chapters from Jacob, it is impressive that such a high fraction of his works are in the top rankings of Table 3. Interestingly, only five of Nephi 1's own chapters are also listed, excluding two chapters quoting Lehi and two chapters quoting Jacob, beginning with 1 Nephi 22 at number 10, a chapter that begins with a reference to the plates of brass, verse 1. Then follow 1 Nephi 14 at number 15, 1 Nephi 12 at number 32, 1 Nephi 15 at number 33, and 1 Nephi 13 at number 39. Jacob's words seem to have a higher density on average of parallels to the book of Moses than Nephi 1's words. To be fair, two highly ranked chapters of Nephi 1 were excluded for having less than 500 words, 1 Nephi 9 and 2 Nephi 11. Alma's writings and sermons from the book of Alma appear in 11 of the top 40 chapters, showing a strong connection to brass plates. So table 3 is titled Top 40 Chapters with the Most Parallels per 1,000 Words and Over 500 Words per Chapter. And for number 1 again is Ether 8, then comes 2 Nephi 12, Alma 41, Alma 12, Alma 13, Jacob 4, Messiah 3, Helaman 6, Messiah 9, 1 Nephi 22, those are just the first 10. And it goes down all the way to number 40, Alma 37, with number of and in this table we have several columns: number of times the verses are cited, number of unique verses, number of distribution, number of distinct parallels, words, and then parallels per 1,000 words. Okay. With this background on the distribution of parallels in the Book of Mormon, we can now consider the relationship to the rest of the JST to the Book of Mormon before turning to the question of the translation process and the impact on the proposed parallels. Connections to the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. The Joseph Smith translation of the Bible is one of the least understood aspects of Joseph Smith's work as a seer and translator. Many have been confused over its status and importance. I recommend Kent P. Jackson's Understanding Joseph Smith's Translation of the Bible as a key source covering the history of the project, including its timelines, the scribes involved, the related manuscripts, and its significance for Latter-day Saints. For examining changes in the JST, I have relied on Kenneth and Lyndall Lute's Joseph Smith Translation, every revision in the Old and New Testament, Old and New Testaments. As Jackson shows in the detailed timeline for Joseph Smith's work on the JST, the Visions of Moses, now Moses 1, began to be translated in June 1830, with the subsequent material in our Book of Moses being completed in February or March 1831, as shown in Table 4, based on Jackson. After the translation of the Old Testament reached Genesis 24, verse 41, Joseph Smith turned to the New Testament and only returned to the Old Testament between July 1832 to 2nd July 1833, spanning Genesis 24, verse 41 to Malachi. There is no evidence of any further work on the translation after 2 July 1833, when Frederick G. Williams, the JST scribe at the time, wrote, quote, finished on the second day of July 1833, unquote, on the last line of the Old Testament manuscript. Many have heard that the JST was never finished, but Jackson makes it clear that Joseph did in fact complete the translation. And here's Table 4. The title is Timeline for the Book of Moses Translation, three columns, section of the Book of Moses, translation dates, and corresponding Genesis material. So it begins with Moses 1, which began in June 1830, and there's no corresponding Genesis material for that. Then Moses 2, verse 1 to 543, completed in 21st October 1831, spanning Genesis 11, 18, and so on, going all the way down to Moses 8:30, which was completed 7th of March 1831, and that was spanning Genesis 6, verses 1 through 13. And there's a footnote on that title, or a little asterisk, followed by this: the material translated from 4th of February to 7th of March 1831 also included the translation of Genesis 6, verse 14 to 24, or to chapter 24, verse 41, not part of the Book of Moses. So the translation of Moses 8, 13 to 30 may have been completed in February 1831. Does the completion of the JST mean that the finished work was of one cloth from beginning to end, in terms of its revelatory nature and origins? There is obviously a wide diversity in the nature of the edits that Joseph made. Numerous changes occur to be minor ones, and that clarify a confusing or troubling word, or add a minor detail. And other passages, such as the Visions of Moses, or Moses chapter 1, and the Enoch material, read like grand epic revelations restoring ancient visions and text. What do we make of the diverse material in the JST? Jackson notes the diversity in Joseph's approach and the sources that seem to have influenced his work. Quote, As the Gospel writers had sources for their writing and revision, what were the sources Joseph Smith used to accomplish his task? From what we can see in the New Translation, it appears that his sources included, in varying degrees, revelation, other scriptural text, his prophetic instincts, and his common sense, unquote. Jackson then shares a variety of examples that seem like Joseph was applying common sense, other sources, or his own understanding to make modifications. Then Jackson contrasts those with passages having significant insertions of text, e.g. the words of Enoch, that quote, show all the hallmarks of revelation that Latter-day Saints are accustomed to seeing in other revealed sources such as the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants, unquote. Even then, he points out that as with all our ancient scriptures, we do not know to what degree the JST summarizes, paraphrases, or generalizes. In short, the JST... that was a quote. In short, the JST is a complicated text resulting from a mix of approaches and sources, including but not necessarily limited to divine revelation. The possibility of Joseph's using different methods to produce the JST may be important in explaining the relationships that can be identified with the Book of Mormon. Likewise, Royal Skousen proposes a complex and nuanced JST with a diverse mix of divine revelation coupled with Joseph's personal work or of revision. This perspective was supported in detail in a 2005 paper. Further comparison of Bible quotations in the Book of Mormon with the JST are considered in his 2019 volume, The History of the Text of the Book of Mormon, Part 5, The King James Quotations in the Book of Mormon. If the Book of Moses, the first portion of Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible, JST, and a canonized text with the Pearl of Great Price, shows such strong connections with the Book of Mormon, should we not expect something similar for the rest of the JST, if the entire JST was a similar revelatory product restoring ancient texts that might have been present on the brass plates, then perhaps we should hope to find similar pervasive parallels. But considering the diverse nature of the JST, as shown in the analysis of scholars such as Jackson and Skousen, such expectations must be tempered. This question was briefly addressed in the 2024 paper, Further Evidence from the Book of Mormon for a Book of Moses-like Text on the Brass Plates. Quote, we have focused on the Book of Mormon. We have focused on the Book of Moses and its connections to the Book of Mormon. But what about the rest of the added or modified text that Joseph gave us in his work of translating the Bible after producing the text that became our Book of Moses? In other words, after revealing the visions of Moses in Moses 1 and then translating Genesis up to Genesis 6:13, where the Book of Moses suddenly ends, what about the rest of the new material from the translation work that continued as Joseph worked with numerous portions of the rest of the KJV Bible? Does it also have the connections we have found to the Book of Mormon? Based on an examination of the remaining text of the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, the answer in general appears to be no, though JST Genesis 50 does provide text closely aligned with 2 Nephi 3, as we might expect, and some changes in Isaiah align with those previously given in the Book of Mormon. A detailed report is in preparation, but it seems that the intricate textual relationships with the Book of Mormon, seen in Moses 4 and other portions of the Book of Moses, do not persist in the later parts of Joseph's translation of the Bible, unquote. More detailed study of the JST has only strengthened the prior impression that the Book of Moses is a unique part of the JST with respect to the Book of Mormon. In my examination of potential Book of Mormon connections to the JST, the relationship to the initial canonized portion of the JST, the Book of Moses, seems extensive and pervasive, while later passages in the JST seem generally unrelated except for several large passages that have the feel of being adapted largely verbatim from the existing Book of Mormon text. These passages include JST Genesis 50, which seems to draw upon 2 Nephi 3 and the vision of Joseph of Egypt in a future of a future Joseph, and JST Isaiah 29 verses 6 and 8 to 34, which follows 2 Nephi 27, 2 through 34, almost verbatim, but skips verse 7. Before examining these passages, the relationship between JST Isaiah 50 and 2 Nephi 7 should be considered. There are several minor differences, but an important story emerges from the textual data. These relationships were considered by Skousen in his 2005 paper, where he raised JST Isaiah 50 as an example of Joseph copying from the Book of Mormon in creating related passages in the JST. He did this in the first of several he did this in the first of several concerns he raises about the assumption of the entire JST being a revealed text. Quote, and again, this is from Skousen, "In my mind, there are some serious difficulties in accepting the totality of the JST as a revealed text from the Lord. In many instances, the JST appears to be to represent Joseph Smith's commentary and explication of difficult readings in the Bible. Instead of simply declaring that the entire JST is inspired, it would be better, I believe, to have a more open discussion of some of the difficulties that the JST presents to the researcher, especially when comparing the JST with other LDS canonized works. Besides the difficulties in determining the actual text of the JST, there are more substantial problems that must be resolved before fully accepting the JST in its entirety as a revealed text from the Lord. Here I list some of these problems. 1. The first part of the JST looks like a word-for-word revealed text, in particular the vision of Moses and that first part of Genesis that has been canonized in the Book of Moses in the Pearl of Great Price. The manuscript OT1, that's Old Testament 1, the initial scribal document recording Joseph Smith's translations of the Old Testament, of the OT, in many respects looks much like the manuscripts for the Book of Mormon. But in switching to the New Testament, and then in returning eventually to the Old Testament, Joseph Smith seems to have switched from providing a word-for-word revelation, much like the Book of Mormon, to making minor changes and relatively small additions to the difficult readings in the Bible." That's the important passage, and it's in bold. "It is not surprising that the more significant doctrinal items in the JST have, for the most part, already been canonized in the Pearl of Great Price or indirectly accepted through various revelations found in the Doctrine and Covenants. Near the end of his work on the JST, Joseph resorted to marking up his Bible and having the scribes write only the changes in the associated manuscript. Even more secondary was, quote, or was in bold now, was his decision for the JST version of Isaiah 50 to have the text directly copied from the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon." Now the bold is off. "Thus leaving the corresponding page of his Bible totally unmarked for this chapter of Isaiah, pages 820 to 23 of that Bible. And for that part of the JST, the text from the 1830 edition is slavishly copied, including all of the errors that had entered the Book of Mormon text during its earlier transmission. Examples: when I come instead of when I came, their river instead of the river, they die instead of they dieth, waketh instead of wakeneth two times, appointed mine ear instead of opened mine ear. The original manuscript of the Book of Mormon is..." We're still continuing with Skousen's quote. "The original manuscript of the Book of Mormon is extant for each of these verses and reads according to the King James Bible. It is obvious that as the work on the JST progressed, the revealed nature of the text was not sustained at the same level." Unquote. The availability of the original manuscript for 2 Nephi 7 allowed Skousen to confirm that JST Isaiah 50 was simply copied from the 1830 Book of Mormon. It is possible that Nephi 1 had access to a version of Isaiah 50 closer to the version in 2 Nephi 7 and JST Isaiah 50 than the KJV. But in terms of textual influence, the Book of Mormon was the source for JST Isaiah 50. Turning now to JST Genesis 50 and its relationship to 2 Nephi 3, this relationship is complex. It is easy to conclude that the added material in Genesis 50 has been copied from the Book of Mormon, but what may have been copied also shows signs of periodically being thoughtfully edited or slightly reworked along the way. Not all of Lehi 1's words are found in JST Genesis 50. And not all the added material in JST Genesis 50 is present in 2 Nephi 3. In general, though, JST Genesis 50, verses 24 to 35, largely corresponds with 2 Nephi 3, 5 to 18. The extensive level of verbatim overlap is unlike the intertextuality seen across the Book of Mormon with respect to the Book of Moses, where short phrases and terms are employed in many paraphrases and allusions rather than extensive verbatim quotes. While I lean toward proposing that a reworking of 2 Nephi 3 may account for JST Genesis 50, Kent Jackson's proposal is also reasonable. Quote, Perhaps the best conclusion for understanding the relationship between JST Genesis and 2 Nephi 3 is that both the plates of brass and the proto-Genesis text or some other ancient document contain records of the prophecy of ancient Joseph. The version Lehi quoted was apparently longer because it continues after the JST version comes to an end. When revising the Old Testament, Joseph Smith may have drawn upon the words in the Book of Mormon when the two accounts were close enough to the same, but even that is speculation. Unquote. We now consider JST Isaiah 29 verses 6 and 8 to 34, which closely follows 2 Nephi 27, 2 to 34. Nephi 1 appears to be reworking Isaiah as he adds his own prophecies regarding the latter days and the Book of Mormon. Again, this looks like extensive overlap, consistent with largely importing the Book of Mormon into the JST. Jackson notes that the Book of Mormon text here was copied onto the JST manuscript, where the 1830 version of 2 Nephi 27:3-35 is reproduced, quote, including all the 1830 paragraph breaks but one, unquote. Apart from these examples, there is little evidence of other meaningful connections between the Book of Mormon and the JST with any of the characteristics seen in parallels with the Book of Moses. One possibility that can be considered is JST Genesis 14:25-40, a passage that deals with Melchizedek and shows a slight resonance with Alma 13, verses 14-19. Melchizedek is said to have been ordained a high priest, quote, after the order of the covenant, unquote, that God made with Enoch, JST Genesis 14-27. Likewise, Alma 13:14 indicates that Melchizedek was a high priest, a detail not explicitly stated in the KJV Bible, though the term high priest is associated with his name several times. Quote, an high priest after the order of Melchizedek, unquote, Hebrews 5:10, and, quote, an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, unquote, Hebrews 6:20, 7:21, and compare Psalm 110, verse 4. Related language pertaining to priesthood is found in parallel number 2, which is order, hyphen days, hyphen years, hyphen eternity, based on Moses 6:67 and Alma 13:7, and in parallel number 52, quote, ordained, with ellipses, after the order, unquote, of the Son of God or of God, based on Moses 8:19, but compare Moses 6:67-68, and 2 Nephi 6, and 2 Nephi 6:2, and Alma 13:1-2, but compare Alma 13:6-10 and 14, and several other verses. The concept of men being ordained as high priest is also found in the KJV, Hebrews 5:1 and 8:3. In short, JST Genesis 14 does not seem to offer a compelling source for the language already considered in Alma 13. But it is interesting. A few other minor elements were also interesting, but not that notable. For example, JST Isaiah 65:2 adds, their works are evil, which is like part of Alma 4:14, quote, and if their works are evil, they shall be restored unto them for evil, unquote. While that phrase does not occur in the KJV, closely related language includes the works thereof are evil, John 7:7, his own works were evil, 1 John 3:12, every evil work, 2 Timothy 4:18, etc. Thus, JST Isaiah 65:2 does not appear to provide a meaningful parallel to the Book of Mormon. The Sermon at the Temple, as John Welch has appropriately called the version of the Sermon on the Mount that Christ taught to the Nephites at the Temple in Bountiful, has several differences relative to the King James Bible. Many, but not all, these differences were imported into the JST versions of the Sermon on the Mount, especially in Matthew 5-7, corresponding to 3 Nephi chapters 12-14. For example, added material in JST Matthew 5 verses 3-4 speaks of the blessing to come to others who will hear the apostles preach and believe in their words, especially those who are baptized. They will be visited with fire and the Holy Ghost, roughly following a similar message to the New World disciples in 3 Nephi 12 verse 1. The words that follow in 3 Nephi 12:2 are almost identical to those in JST Matthew 5:4. Quote, yea, blessed are they who shall believe on your words, and come down into the depth of humility, and be baptized in my name. For they shall be visited with fire and the Holy Ghost, and shall receive a remission of their sins. Unquote. Also, the Book of Mormon's well-known addition of "Who come unto me" in the Beatitudes is also imported into the JST. Quote, "Yea, blessed are the pure in spirit who come unto me, for there is the kingdom of heaven." Unquote. JST Matthew 5:5 compared 3 Nephi 12:3. As Skousen notes, while much of the Sermon of the Mount is adapted to follow the Book of Mormon's Sermon at the Temple, there are also instances where the KJV, instead of the Book of Mormon, is followed, and instances where the JST has unique material. There is a heavy but not a slavish reliance on the Book of Mormon. Jackson, for example, in discussing the Sermon on the Mount chapters, notes that, quote, "the prophet made many revisions in Matthew 6 and 7, but did so without consulting the Book of Mormon," unquote. Apart from a revision in Matthew 6:30 that may have been influenced by 3 Nephi 13:30. As interesting as the differences are, they are moot for our purposes since the Book of Mormon material derives directly from the ministry of Christ, and the recorded wording is not likely to have drawn upon New Testament manuscripts that presumably were never available to the Nephites apart from the words of Christ. Thus, the Book of Mormon is likely to have been the source for some changes in the JST versions of the Sermon on the Mount, but almost certainly not the other way around. Apart from some passages in the JST that may have been imported from the Book of Mormon, the JST, after the Book of Moses, simply does not show that kind of relationship to the Book of Mormon that have been the focus of this study. An outpouring of the newly translated ancient material appears to have occurred during the translation of the Book of Moses, yielding material that improbably seems to have influenced the earlier Book of Mormon, possibly through a link to the brass plates. That makes the Book of Moses unique with respect to the Book of Mormon, with a large body of parallels that are difficult to explain as the work of naturalistic forces during Joseph Smith's translation of the two texts. While the Book of Mormon that was canonized in 1880 might seem like it was rather arbitrarily selected from the JST of the Bible up to Genesis 6:13, it seems to have captured revealed material with a surprisingly large number of textual parallels to the Book of Mormon, including textual parallels suggestive of a one-way direction of influence from the Book of Moses to the Book of Mormon. Surely, for these textual parallels to exist, there must have been some common factor in the translation process that allowed connections between the Book of Mormon and the later Book of Moses to remain visible and meaningful. Here we must make some observations on the obvious importance of the translation method. Did the translation method preserve or create the parallels? Do the observations about related language in the Book of Moses and Book of Mormon tell us something about the origins of the two texts, or do such findings more likely tell us about the work and intentions of the translators? Could translation artifacts or other factors account for the parallels without the need for common material on the brass plates? A related and noteworthy question has been raised by David Calabro. Quote, "The evidence brought forward by Lindsay and Reynolds is of great importance. It certainly demonstrates that there are intertextual connections between some of the contents of the brass plates and the restored portions of the Book of Moses. However, the precise relationship between these texts cannot be adequately described without a systematic comparison of the language of the Book of Mormon, the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis, and the New Testament. Such a comparison is beyond the scope of this paper, but some preliminary observations may be offered here. One observation is that the use of New Testament-like language in the Book of Mormon involves a number of unique factors. The foundational revelation given to Nephi in 1 Nephi chapters 11 to 14, which is explicitly linked to the revelation of John, see 1 Nephi 14, 18 to 27, may have prophetically introduced similar language into Nephite discourse. Further, most of the historical narrative in the Book of Mormon is an abridgment by Mormon and Moroni, who lived long after the ministry of Christ among the Nephites. During his ministry, Christ, quote, did expound all things, even from the beginning until the time that he should come in his glory, unquote, 3 Nephi 26:3. The greater part of this discourse, which may have included material similar to the Book of Moses, was recorded on the large plates of Nephi, 3 Nephi 26:7. It is therefore possible that the abridged account is influenced by the language of Christ's teachings. Even quotations from the plates of brass found on the large plates may have been rendered into Christian language in the process of creating the edited text. After all, it is reasonable to imagine Mormon needing to translate the language of the nearly 1,000-year-old plates of brass into his own written idiom. Finally, the possibility of influence from Native American languages and sources is a large unknown factor. It is not out of the question that Native American expressions with no direct relationship to the New Testament were nevertheless close enough in meaning that they were translated into English using New Testament language. Thus, the parallel New Testament-like language in the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses may be explained in various ways. It is not always necessary to conclude that one is derived from the other. Unquote. Calibro's question suggests that we might better understand the significance of related language in the Book of Moses if we also examine the Joseph Smith translation more thoroughly. That examination points to something unique about the Book of Moses not found systematically in other parts of the JST. More generally, Calibro raises the complex nature that multiple issues having the potential to influence the final translation without necessarily requiring the brass plates were a vehicle for textual influence into the Book of Mormon. Here the issue of the distribution of parallels provides useful data. If the various factors that led to the incorporation of New Testament language into the Book of Mormon, such as Mormons and Moroni's Christian vocabulary and their language preferences in translating old records into their vernacular, are key causes for apparent links to the Book of Moses, then we might find that the Book of Moses parallels occur rather uniformly throughout the Book of Mormon. If anything, we might expect the words of post-New Testament era prophets such as Mormon and Moroni to represent the zenith of the distribution, while the small plates writers would have relatively less Book of Moses material, especially since Mormon and Moroni apparently did not rework or translate that material. There's a quotation given, a footnote 28. This, however, is the opposite of what we see. There is not a uniform distribution, and indeed, Mormon's writings have some of the lowest concentrations observed, with the Book of Moroni only slightly higher. It is the ancient small plates, apparently untranslated by Mormon but simply added to the gold plates, that contains the richest concentration of parallels in the words of Lehi 1, Nephi 1, and Jacob. Those most familiar with the brass plates tend to give us the most allusions to the Book of Moses, including subtle one-way allusions that add explanatory power to the text in ways that could not be reasonably achieved by Joseph's mind. The distribution data suggest that something else besides random incorporation of New Testament language is the mechanism for the parallels. There is still certainly the possibility that some of the parallels were not intended by the Book of Mormon authors or speakers and could have been introduced in the modern translation, either by accident or by design, to call attention to a meaningful connection that readers might well consider. Indeed, the translation mechanism demands more attention, for the nature of the parallels observed in our studies suggests that translator intent, or at least translator cooperation, may have been required in many cases to make the parallel clear. Such intent seems to have been at play for both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses. A looser, more functional translation for either volume could have obscured many of the results. This raises the controversial issue of just how the translation was done. A few thoughts will be offered while first observing that the findings reported here do not require any one model of translation apart from translation through the power of God, but some models seem more consistent with our data than others. The details of exactly how Joseph translated the Book of Mormon remain relatively unclear, apart from using revelatory tools such as the Nephite interpreters or a single seer stone, though even that is the source of much controversy and misunderstanding. By the time the Book of Moses was translated, there is no evidence that such tools continued to be used. Jackson notes that none of the many scribes Joseph used during the JST work ever mentioned the use of revelatory aids, and no other information from contemporary sources points to their use. Indeed, a statement from Orson Pratt may explain why they were not used. Quote, Elder Pratt said he was present when this revelation was given, No great noise or physical manifestations was made. Joseph was as calm as the morning sun, but he noticed a change in his countenance that he had never noticed before when a revelation was given to him. Joseph's face was exceedingly white and seemed to shine. The speaker had been present many times when he was translating the New Testament and wondered why he did not use the Urim and Thummim as in translating the Book of Mormon. While this thought passed through the speaker's mind, Joseph, as if he read his thoughts, looked up and explained that the Lord gave him the Urim and Thummim when he was inexperienced in the spirit of inspiration. But now he had advanced so far that he understood the operations of that spirit, and he did not need the assistance of that instrument, unquote. Joseph never explained what processes occurred either in his mind or before his eyes as he translated. It is commonly proposed that Joseph translated the Book of Mormon by looking at a portion of the text to be translated, perhaps through the transparent seer stones of the Nephite interpreters, sometimes called a Urim and Thummim, and, quote, studied out, unquote, in his mind a proposed translation, perhaps responding to spiritual impressions. This, quote, first draft, unquote, of Joseph's composed translation was then taken to the Lord in prayer to see if it could be confirmed with a burning in the bosom. Otherwise, there would be a stupor of thought requiring revision until a proposed translation of the unknown language in an unknown script would finally be accepted, at which point it could be dictated, and then the process would continue for the next few characters. Such a model for the translation is based on what I consider a popular misreading of Doctrine and Covenants 9, verses 7 to 9, which many believe is a revelation about how Book of Mormon translation was done. On closer inspection, this may be incorrect. In a paper on this famous passage of the Doctrine and Covenants, Stan Spencer provided detailed analysis giving an important conclusion. Quote, Doctrine and Covenants 9, 7-9 is conventionally interpreted as the Lord's description of the methodology by which the Book of Mormon was translated. A close reading of the entire revelation, however, suggests that the Lord was not telling Oliver Cowdery how to translate, but rather how to know whether it was right for him to translate, and how to obtain the faith necessary to do so, unquote. The analysis includes consideration of what the it must be in, quote, study it out, unquote. Spencer determines that the most reasonable interpretation is that the issue is not how to translate, but whether it was the Lord's will for Oliver to translate. Spencer concludes that, quote, Doctrine and Covenants 9, 7-9 teaches us how to obtain a spiritual confirmation of a righteous desire, unquote. Or, as my wife Kendra Lindsay put it, we might summarize the it of Doctrine and Covenants 9, verse 8 as the question, am I right before the Lord and ready to translate? Or, quote, is the time right and the translator ready, unquote. In any case, the laborious iterative composition process implied by a popular reading of Doctrine and Covenants 9, 7-9 for the task of translating an unknown language and script cannot reasonably fit the data on the extreme speed of the translation process, or on the remarkable consistency and intertextuality of the resulting English. Extensive data from various witnesses to the translation and also from analysis of the dictated text, points to the translation work as associated with the role of a seer who somehow saw the translated text and was able to then provide it to the scribes. Though later adjustments to the text for clarity were certainly possible for Joseph, it seems that his work as a seer in translating an unknown script was not one of gradually getting impressions for Reformed Egyptian characters to pray about, but one of seeing the translated text and reading it aloud to the scribes. This is also consistent with Nephi 1's prophecies of the forthcoming of the Book of Mormon in 2 Nephi 27, verses 20, 22, and 24, which three times says that Joseph would, quote, read the words, unquote, of the Book of Mormon, something that, quote, the learned, unquote, was not able to do. One of several excellent papers applying linguistic data to support the notion that Joseph saw translation that he read to his scribes is a work of Stanford Carmack with the fitting title, Joseph Smith Read the Words. Indeed, there is a sizable body of work from both Skousen and Carmack indicating that the language Joseph employed in his dictation of the Book of Mormon was generally tightly controlled, suggesting that it was not being composed by Joseph Smith in his own words on the fly, but that the English translation was given to him. The English given to him was not his own dialect, but but contain many archaic elements from early modern English, including many that reflect influence from before the time when the KJV Bible was translated. We don't yet understand why there should be a strong influence of non-KJV early modern English in the dictated translation, but the data is there and remains compelling. While counter arguments can be made, the phenomenon of extensive intertextuality with the Book of Moses seems consistent with the work and conclusions of Skousen and Carmack and may add an additional dimension to their proposals. In our studies to date on connections between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon, the outcomes that have been reported are largely based on the use of common words or expressions that make the connection apparent. Had the translation of either the Book of Mormon or the Book of Moses been simply expressed in Joseph's own language, with the semantic variability that can easily occur when one is doing the heavy lifting of expressing meaning in one's own words, with one's own choice of words, many and perhaps most of the parallels might not have been detected. Further, as Rebecca Lambert observed, a more uniform distribution across chapters edited by Mormon might be expected if Mormon were responsible for most of these parallels. Reynolds' initial paper, based on the computer matches of specific words and many other parallels, were found by searching for specific words and phrases as well. In many ways, it seems that tight control was applied for at least some of the language in both the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon. Or in other words, at least the translator or translators may have wanted the parallel to be noticed. Such reasoning does not necessarily mean that Nephi 1 deliberately chose words that alluded to a brass plate's version of Genesis, but intent on his part still seems likely. Intent looks especially likely in the high levels of allusions found in his work and in the subtly meaningful applications of those allusions. One example is Laman's implicit characterization of Nephi 1 as satanic in 1 Nephi 16:38 by his subtle reference to Moses 4:4 on the characteristics of Satan, parallel number 11. This parallel, with its explanatory power, only makes sense when understood as having a one-way direction of influence on 1 Nephi, and it makes the most sense if Nephi 1 was fully aware of the implications and the extreme irony of the charges. Interestingly, Laman's charges against Nephi 1, involved with parallel number 11, echo across the centuries of Lamanite culture. We know of lasting Lamanite hatred of the Nephites from Isaiah 10, verses 11 to 17, based on the anger of Laman and Lemuel, who said that Nephi 1 robbed them. This hatred is expressed much later during the ministry of the sons of Mosiah to the Lamanites, when Ammon, too, is journeying with his regal convert, King Lamoni, and meets King Lamoni's father on the road. King Lamoni speaks up for Ammon, too, as a servant of God and friend to the Lamanites, but the father shocks the son with his outrage. Quote, "And now when Lamoni had rehearsed unto him all these things, behold, to his astonishment, his father was angry with him, and said, Lamoni, thou art going to deliver these Nephites, who are sons of a liar. Behold, he robbed our fathers, and now his children are also come amongst us, that they may, by their cunning and their lyings, deceive us, that again they may rob us of our property." Sons of a liar was in bold, as is their cunning and their lyings deceive us, from Alma 20, verse 13. With these words, King Lamoni's father is not just reciting general charges of Nephite oppression, but he is also King Lamoni's father. But he is also responsible. He is also regurgitating a specific ancient charge of his forefathers. His words call our attention to Laman's condemnation of their brother, which in turn alludes to the Book of Moses. Consider these verses related to parallel number 11. From Moses 4:4, "And he became Satan, yea, even the devil, the father of all lies, to deceive and to blind men, and to lead them captive at his will, even as many as would not hearken unto my voice." And then from 1 Nephi 16:38 in the Book of Mormon, "Now he says that the Lord has talked with him, and also that angels have ministered unto him. But behold, we know that he lies unto us, and he tells us these things, and he worketh many things by his cunning arts, that he may deceive our eyes, thinking perhaps that he may lead us away into some strange wilderness. And after he has led us away, he has thought to make himself a king and a ruler over us, that he may do according to his will and pleasure. And after this manner did my brother Laman stir up their hearts to anger." Unquote. Just as Naaman alludes to Moses 4:4 to suggest that Nephi 1 was following the father of all lies, lying to his brethren to deceive them and bind them, and blind them, to lead them away as captives with his cunning or subtle arts, so King Lamoni's father describes Ammon too, the Nephite, as the son of a liar, whose alleged miracles are due to his satanic cunning arts, again trying to deceive the Lamanites in order to exploit them. The ancient words of Father Laman still reverberate strongly in the mind of the great Lamanite king, words that must be understood as a meaningful and ironic allusion to Moses 4:4, though King Lamoni's father may have had no knowledge of that verse, just the ancient accusation. Words like lyings, liar, deceive, and cunning help establish the echo of Laman's charge in 1 Nephi 16:38, and thus its connection to Moses 4:4. This scene in one verse of Alma 20 still has unexpected resonance with a much older allusion to the brass plates version of Genesis, apparently made by Laman centuries earlier. Such finds, minor as they may be, point to the richness of the intertextuality of the Book of Mormon and the blessings to us provided by the careful wording of the English translators of both the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon that help us learn from these features. Whether one believes that Joseph Smith had to do the heavy lifting of studying out the translation of the gold plates in his own mind or not, the translation process ultimately was revelatory and has given us an English text with meaningful ancient echoes, often pointing to an influence on Book of Mormon figures by a proposed brass plates version of Genesis, akin to our Book of Moses. Some of the parallels could be due to chance, and others might not have been intended by an early Book of Mormon writer, but may have been provided or amplified either by later editorial work by Mormon or in translation work by whoever crafted the English translation, whether that was a heavenly being or a young Joseph Smith acting under inspiration. In any case, the diverse results seem to require divine aid rather than human work of a clever composer named Joseph Smith. The mysterious details of the divine translation work of Joseph Smith play an important role here. The strong similarity in language that characterizes most of the parallels between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses would seem to require a relatively tightly controlled translation process, apparently tailored to make the relationships clear or detectable. For the Book of Mormon, the translated parallels may have involved speakers of Hebrew, Aramaic, or later descendant languages who read a presumably Egyptian version of Genesis, translated it to their language, or at least for the sermons and dialogues of the Book of Mormon, and then transcribed that onto the gold plates in Reformed Egyptian, which in turn was finally translated to English. Meanwhile, the Book of Moses could have been translated from an unknown Egyptian document by or attributed to Moses, or from a document in Hebrew, or some other language related to a document originally from Moses, or perhaps it was translated directly into English from a brass plates version of Genesis. In any case, the linguistic family tree of the English Book of Mormon is different than that of the Book of Moses. So obtaining such extensive intertextuality in the final products would seem to require deliberate choices made in the final translation. Given that this intertextuality involves the later translated Book of Moses, serving as a rich mother lode for allusions and references in the earlier Book of Mormon, it is unlikely that Joseph was the source of the wording. Translator intent or translator cooperation seems to be required for at least portions of both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses. The proposal of translator intent or cooperation playing a significant role in preserving parallels or making them noticeable to English readers raises the issue of how the English syntax of the Book of Moses compares to the Book of Mormon. Does it show a strong influence of early modern English and a disconnection with Joseph's own dialect? If the English verbiage of the Book of Moses had been adjusted to maintain linguistic connections with the Book of Mormon, then it would seem reasonable that the style and syntax of the Book of Moses overall might be like that of the Book of Mormon. This is indeed what the data appears to show. Stanford Carmack's 2021 paper, The Original English of the Book of Moses and What It Indicates About the Book's Authorship, examined 30 different linguistic categories and compared their traits across the Book of Moses. The Book of Mormon, the Book of Mormon, the KJV Bible, Joseph's early writings, and a pseudo-archaic corpus of texts that tried to imitate archaic biblical syntax. Carmack's findings are significant. Quote, Joseph Smith's native usage can explain 30% of Book of Moses usage, pseudo-archaism 44%, and King James usage 37%. The Book of Mormon, however, is able to account for most of the patterns and forms investigated, 86% of them by this count. It is possible, of course, to include other features which would change the percentages somewhat, but the Book of Mormon falls short of being able to explain a few of the linguistic parallels mentioned in Table 2, most notably the past tense usage. The few usage issues it cannot explain occur in the early modern period. Indeed, broader early modern usage, most of the time not Joseph Smith's modern usage, accounts for all the linguistic features. Thus, the simplest explanation of the Book of Moses' English usage would be to adapt an early modern perspective. In other words, that a text showing true early modern sensibility and language, in language use, was revealed to Joseph in 1830. End quote. The English language of the Book of Mormon, as dictated by Joseph Smith, is by far closest to the Book of Mormon. But it has some notable differences that can be accounted for as a slightly different form of early modern English influence on the translation than is present in the Book of Mormon. Of course, naturalistic explanations for Joseph's work of translation would also suggest that the two texts should be similar since they ought to reflect his own language. But the data show linguistic analysis of the Book of Moses. But the data from linguistic analysis of the Book of Moses shows that it is not simply the same as the Book of Mormon, and importantly, does not follow Joseph's syntax. Just as the language of the Book of Mormon cannot be explained as Joseph's syntax or as his effort to imitate the King James Bible, Carmack's analysis is consistent with an English translation intended to preserve linguistic connections with the Book of Mormon. These parallels are different in nature to those employed by critics. A recently posed question involves the potential downside of emphasizing parallels to another text. After all, aren't such parallels also used to attack the Book of Mormon? The parallels in this study are of a different nature than those often employed by critics of the Book of Mormon. Various pre-1829 texts have been proposed as sources that Joseph plagiarized or drew upon, based on words, similar names, phrases, or sometimes themes. Upon further investigation, many such parallels reflect common phrases in the English language, KJV language, or perhaps random chance, especially when the matches are based on common words whose shared usage seems trivial and random. Some attacks are based on similar-sounding names occurring in unrelated context. Such parallels generally lack substance or explanatory power. For examples of treatments of the flaws and lack of significance in some popular smoking guns for Book of Mormon origins, see Benjamin L. McGuire, the Late War Against the Book of Mormon. Also, the Fair Latter-day Saints answer to Was the Beginning of the Book of Mormon Derived from the First Book of Napoleon? And Benjamin McGuire's Finding Parallels, Some Cautions and Criticisms, Part 1 and Part 2. Also see my response to suggestions that the place name Nahum in the Book of Mormon is easily explained based on its alleged ubiquity around the world. On the other hand, the parallels in the Book of Mormon discussed here are parallels to an English volume that had not been produced and frequently add meaning or depth to the Book of Mormon text, as we expect when one text makes an intentional allusion to another document. Some of them, the parallels, may be due to chance, as we have repeatedly noted, but many fit the context or add meaning in ways indicative of intent, and even point to a Book of Moses-related text that provides a backstory or context for the allusion. As a body, they have explanatory power that helps us recognize meaningful relationships. As such, they weaken rather than strengthen claims of modern plagiarism by Joseph. This project began with a quest for answers, not a search for parallels to support a preconceived argument. It began with my puzzling over 1 Nephi 4:2, where Nephi tries to motivate his brethren by saying, Let us be strong, like unto Moses, for he truly spake under the waters of the Red Sea, and they divided hither and thither. I wanted to know what Nephi was alluding to, for I could find nothing in the Old Testament calling Moses strong. That's when I learned of Noel Reynolds' paper pointing to the 33 connections between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses. Intrigued, I began examining the Book of Moses and quickly found a clear connection that helped to explain what Nephi might have been referring to. "Blessed art thou, Moses, for I, the Almighty, have chosen thee, and thou shalt be made stronger than many waters, for they shall obey thy command as if thou wert God." That was Moses 1:25. It was the perfect candidate for a source describing Moses as strong in the context of crossing the Red Sea as the waters obeyed his command, as in 1 Nephi 4:2. This was not a random parallel with a couple of similar words being used, but one that offered a specific common context and had explanatory power. That find offered a satisfying answer to a legitimate question and added relevant background to a Book of Mormon passage. Many of the subsequently discovered parallels likewise answer questions and add richness to the Book of Mormon text. This goes beyond parallelomania. Conclusion. In the process of addressing reasonable questions about the connections between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses, several further discoveries have been made which seem to strengthen the case for meaningful ancient relationships. The patterns in the distribution of the parallels show non-random results in which those writers most familiar with the brass plates are most likely to allude to material related to the Book of Moses. Intriguing insights can be obtained by looking at the level of individual books, chapters within books, and verses themselves. The density of parallels in some sections, such as the words of Lehi 1, is noteworthy, but we can also learn much from the gaps where one or more chapters are free of parallels. Exploring the Joseph Smith translation also shows that something unique occurred for the initial portion of the JST that became our canonized Book of Moses. Perhaps a revelatory outpouring rooted in ancient text occurred in that initial work, followed by continuing revelation, but in ways less directly related to the Book of Mormon. The pervasive and often meaningful connections between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon are not found in the remaining JST, just as they are not found within the Book of Abraham. This contributes to the wonder and uniqueness of the Book of Moses connections and undermines theories that the connections can be explained by Joseph Smith simply reusing familiar Book of Mormon language in his subsequent translation work. The Book of Abraham and the latter portions of the JST are evidence against such naturalistic hypotheses, as are the details of the distribution of the parallels. The hypothesis Reynolds originally proposed was that a text that could have influenced Book of Mormon writers was something like our Book of Moses that might have existed on the brass plates. For the first 33 parallels that Reynolds uncovered, he observed that the writers of the small plates, whom we might expect would be particularly well-schooled in the brass plates, are responsible for most of the Book of Moses' influence that he had identified. Quote, "It is also impressive that most of the influence from the Book of Moses in the Book of Mormon shows up early in the small plates and the writings of the first generation of Book of Mormon prophets. Significantly, those who had custody and long-term, first-hand access to the brass plates. Many of the later passages that use Book of Moses terminology and concepts tend to repeat earlier Nephite adaptations of the original materials." Over time, his hypothesis, based on only 33 parallels, has held up well, and now over 140 parallels have been identified. It is still the case that several small plate authors or speakers have particularly high levels of parallels, though we can also appreciate many more important parallels across many books. The surprisingly high level of intertextuality between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon presents a series of challenges to those who claim Joseph Smith was the author of both. I propose that a study of these parallels, their characteristics, and the insights they provide can help us better appreciate the ancient origins of both texts. Such investigation can also help us appreciate the marvel of the divine translation process that gave us the English, especially when we consider the chronology of the translation work. For example, consider parallel number 11. It has these words, lies, lead, will, deceive, eyes, from Moses 4:4, with relationships to 1 Nephi 16:38, with a newly added cross-reference to Alma 20:13, newly added in the updates provided in Table 1 of Part 2 for this series. Here's the passage. And now when Lamoni, this is quoting from Alma 20:13. And now when Lamoni had rehearsed unto him all these things, behold, to his astonishment, his father was angry with him, and said, Lamoni, thou art going to deliver these Nephites, who are sons of a liar. Behold, he robbed our fathers, and now his children also come amongst us, that they may, by their cunning and their lyings, deceive us, that they again may rob us of our property. This recalls Laman's charges against Nephi 1 in 1 Nephi 16:38. Now he says that the Lord has talked with him, and also that angels have ministered unto him. But behold, we know that he lies unto us, and he tells us these things, and he worketh many things by his cunning arts, that he may deceive our eyes, thinking perhaps that he may lead us away into some strange wilderness. And after he has led us away, he has thought to make himself a king and a ruler over us, that he may do with us according to his will and his pleasure. And after this manner did my brother Laman stir up their hearts in anger. The words of King Lamoni's father in Alma 20:13 were dictated shortly after the book of Mosiah, but long before the dictation turned to the small plates, having the recrimination against the, quote, son of a liar, unquote, worded to allude to Laman's ancient accusation, before that story was even translated and written in English, is a remarkable thing for a text dictated on the fly without notes at a high rate of speed and without major revisions. If the Book of Mormon were a modern composition, how does the author of Alma 20 subtly allude to a backstory that hasn't been written yet, with the precisely worded backstory to be filled in weeks later, near the end of the translation process when 1 Nephi 16:38 is reached? And then how does one craft that verse to allude to yet another backstory, the characterization of Satan to come later in Moses 4:4, not dictated until well over a year would pass? Joseph, as the author of such subtle, forward-looking allusion, seems improbable. Many such questions abound in the utterly unexpected connections between the Book of Mormon and the later translated text of the Book of Moses, which improbably seems to provide the backstory to and key terminology for many aspects of the earlier Book of Mormon. This all makes little sense, especially when considering Joseph's education and the translation process observed by many witnesses, unless one can entertain the possibility of real ancient text with real ancient authors, where one ancient text could influence the other, and where both were produced, quote, in the wrong order, unquote, in modern times, by a prophet translating with the power of God. It's a surprising story based on surprising and unexpected data. Alternate hypotheses and new questions are welcome as we explore the implications of the data, but for now, the connections between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon strike me as important evidence for the divinity, authenticity, and antiquity of both texts, and for their miraculous translation into English. That's the end. Jeffrey D. Lindsay has been providing online materials defending the church for more than 20 years, primarily at jefflindsay.com. His Mormanity blog on church topics began in 2004 and was recently converted to arisefromthedust.com. He is currently on the board of directors for the Interpreter Foundation. Jeff has a PhD in chemical engineering from BYU and is a U.S. patent agent. Jeff has been a fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers since 2014 and goes on. Let's see, from 2011 to 2019, he was the head of intellectual property for Asia Pulp and Paper in Shanghai, China, one of the world's largest forest product companies. Formerly, he was associate professor at the Institute of Paper Science and Technology, now the Renewable Bioproducts Institute at Georgia Tech, then went into R&D at Kimberly-Clark Corporation, eventually becoming corporate patent strategist and senior research fellow. Jeff served a mission in the German-speaking Switzerland Zurich mission. He and his wife, Kendra, are the parents of four boys and have 15 grandchildren. They're both serving as ministering specialists for African immigrants in their community and are learning Swahili. Jeff also serves as a board member for Hope and Help Together, a community organization in Appleton, Wisconsin, which works to assist refugees and immigrants in the Fox Cities region. This has been a recording of Parallels Between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon, Part 1. Details of Their Distribution and Relationships to the JST by Jeffrey D. Lindsay, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, Volume 67, 2025, read by Jeffrey Lindsay. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged. The journal and its website are accredited and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many other articles can be found at journal.interpreterfoundation.org. More information about the Interpreter Foundation, along with a wide array of additional resources, can be found at interpreterfoundation.org. And thank you for listening.